Welcome, everybody, to episode 255 of the Metabolus 2 podcast. A feature of myself, Ben, who is recording from the storm-tossed planet of Minnesota. Sorry.
You threw me off.
I know. It's all about throwing you off. It's all about throwing you off. Anyway, yeah. Carry on.
And I am David, and sure. Far, far away from any storms in the balmy state of Oregon.
Lovely, 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 lovely. And I think this week we are carrying on with our martyrology.
Yes, continuing on. And we're up to 1975 here, but information still is coming in with Ian's Oxford years. So I think we should touch upon that.
Please do. I mean, I think you're the one who's been at the coalface digging up nuggets of martyr facts.
Yeah, What I am finding is Ian was pretty heavily involved in drama in and around Oxford University, not just within the John Oldham Society of St. Edmund Hall, but it is beginning to seem like he was involved with every college's production, perhaps, or as much as he could. And some interesting tidbits. We're not going to rehash the Oxford years, but he was in a musical. The musical was You Can't Do Much Without a Screwdriver. Book, music, and lyrics were by Chris Miller. It was directed by David Wood. And Ian Martyr starred in it. And he starred as Guy Fawkes, an amnesia nationalist.
Yes. I mean, just immediately going to jump in there. I mean, obviously, there is a record. There is a recording of this.
There is a recording, yes.
Yes.
Of Ian singing.
We've kind of got no idea what it was about, particularly. But I'm going to say that if the leading character was called Guy Fawkes, it's got something, it's satirical and political, because that sounds a lot like Guy Fawkes to me.
Yes, it was set in London, 1965, in the place of Amnesia, 1899. And it was censored by the Lord Chancellor, which you explained to me, I can't remember what you said.
Well, until 1968, every play in Britain, from Shakespeare onwards, was subject to the approval of the Lord Chancellor. So you couldn't put on any play at all without sending the script to the Lord Chancellor's office. And then I guess the Lord Chancellor didn't read it himself. He probably had someone to do it for him. Or her. No, it's usually a him. And you would get a list of notes back from the Lord Chancellor saying, cut that, don't want that, please send me more of this. Mm-hmm. And every play got that. Eventually, I mean, that was starting to break down in the mid-60s. I mean, a lot of the kind of, you know, satirists that would go on to be Pythons, or, you know, Peter Cook and Dudley Moore, John Miller, the satire boom of the 1960s really put the end to having that be a sensible thing, if it ever was a sensible thing. So that stopped in 1968. And I mean, there's still a British Board of Film Censorship, so all films are reviewed by a censor and cut according to public taste, I believe. But plays can do what they want. And actually, ironically, I think the other push to stop the review of the Lord Chancellor's Office of All Plays was the Royal Court Theatre, which, as we know from last week's podcast, Ian was tangentially involved with, i.e. putting on plays that had been at the Royal Court.
Mm-hmm. So just to complete the circle here, the things that the Lord Chamberlain's office was concerned about, they said, quote, there must be no impersonation of the present prime minister or his predecessor. And then they also wanted some song lyrics sent to them for further review. So you can see how they were cracking down on perhaps mocking the establishment.
Yeah. And again, I mean, I think one of the first major challenges to the censorship of the Lord Chancellor's office was impersonations of Macmillan. Lord Macmillan. He wasn't Lord then. He was just plain old Macmillan. In the early 1960s, I think Macmillan stopped being Prime Minister 1963 or 64, and then it was Sir Alec Douglas Hume. I think Macmillan was, Lord Stockton was in poorish health. He had been through the ringer during World War One. And at the time that Marta was putting on these plays, the Prime Minister would have been Harold Wilson.
1965, yeah.
Prime Minister fact fans.
So, yeah, it was, I think, a charity recording or just something. It was something to raise funds for Oxford's ETC, Experimental Theatre Company.
Interesting.
And so it was four tracks. The A1 track was Bang On, sung by Ian Martyr. The second track on the first side was You Can't Do Much Without a Screwdriver, sung by David Wood. And then on the B side, Kiss and Make Up by Adele Weston, whose married name is Jarass, and I Did It, Dash It, vocals by Bob Scott. So those are the four people who recorded it. It was an aide of Oxford University Experimental Theater Company. And if you have this record, if you have this piece of vinyl, make a recording of it. Put it on YouTube, because I would really like to hear young Ian Martyr singing in 1965, Bang On.
Well, there is one copy that has been sold on Discogs, I think you found for me,
yes.
For us. There's three people who want it. I did check. It is not on Spotify. and there are currently no copies for sale on eBay. So, though, you know what? This is going to sound crazy. But I don't know, I might email St. Edmunds Hall. And I think what might be worth contacting is the Theatre Society at St. Edmunds Hall, which is still going, right? John Oldham's. John Oldham's Society. And I'll only say this because the Theatre Society that I was in at Worcester recently put out a call for ephemera for productions that we'd put on during the time at Worcester. So colleges tend to collect this stuff. Each college has an archive. You know, if there was a member of, you know, if there were more than one members of St. Edmunds Hall who were in this production, you know, they might have a copy of the record. So I don't know. I might drop them a line.
The other person probably, the actor David Wood, probably might have a copy of it because he seems to have a lot of ephemera.
Oh, interesting.
His time at the university, and he was certainly in productions with Ian Martyr.
Do we know the actor David Wood? Has he been in things that we're aware of?
Well, let's see.
Sorry, I'm putting you on the spot there.
Yeah, David Wood, English actor, born in 1944, which would be right the same age as Ian.
Cool.
He was at Worcester College, Oxford.
He was at Worcester. Way.
Yep. Same college as yourself. And he has original plays, so he's a playwright.
Okay.
Mostly known as a dramatist. Actor,
okay.
Author, composer, director, magician, and producer.
What was his connection to the screwdriver play again?
He was, I believe, director, and he also sung in it.
Okay, so Buskins is the drama club at Worcester. I've got a hotline to the archivist who's been collecting stuff for Buskins. I'm wondering whether Wood might have deposited some of his material with Worcester if he was at Worcester. So I will drop her a line, and I will ask her whether David Wood has sent her any stuff and whether there's any records and whether one of those records might be the recording of You Can't Do Anything Without a Screwdriver, and then I'll get to send me a copy.
That'd be excellent. Stay tuned.
Okay, okay, yeah.
This is the production meeting for now, the Season 13 Ian Martyr Doctor Who Blu-ray special.
Exactly. You know, I mean, if we get enough stuff, we could put on a production of You Can't Do Anything, You Can't Do Much Without a Screwdriver at Gallifrey One next year.
There you go.
There you go. I mean, it can't be any worse than all the other stuff they put on, to be honest. I didn't say that, but anyway, yeah.
Yeah. David Wood's most notable work is a two-act musical play premiered in 1976 called The Gingerbread Man, which is based on the German fairy tale, I would guess.
Oh, okay. All right. Very cool. Okay. All right. Yeah, so, I mean, if any of you do have a copy of that record, please let us know because we'd like to hear it.
Indeed, indeed.
Yeah.
So,
cool. Thank you very much.
How do we want to go from here? I guess, so there's just an increasing number of pictures that I've uncovered of Ian at Oxford. A really nice one with his cohorts of John Dodgson and Nick Elliott. But he also knew Peter Ustinov's daughter. Yeah, there's a picture of him with Tamara Ustinov.
Very nice.
There's some pictures him kind of off to the side, laughing at Richard Burton's joke in a pub. And then there's another picture of a bearded Ian Martyr looking on as Liz Taylor and Richard Burton are sitting on a couch talking to other students. It looks like at a party, and then just other production photos, you know, a photo of him with Adele Weston on stage with You Can't Do Much Without a Screwdriver, potentially one of him singing. So there's some photos coming to light of Ian's time at Oxford.
Yeah, which is all, you know, it's all interesting stuff. I mean, this is kind of formative, you know, his formative years. And I think, you know, one point that you were making to me earlier on, mm-hmm. Is it's not a surprise he got a third at all.
No.
Really,
no.
With the amount of drama that he appeared to be doing. I'm surprised he had any time to do any other kind of work. But, you know, I mean, a third is fine. I mean, it's not an unclassified.
He wasn't sent down.
He wasn't sent down for not doing any work at all, which can happen.
Yep.
Being sent down is basically mean you've been expelled.
You're done.
Yeah, you're done. Out of here is what that is. So, yeah, I mean, good on him. As we were saying last time, it's sort of obvious that maybe he would have much rather have gone to drama school, but he was too smart.
Yeah.
You know, that can be a tough thing. I think if you're smart enough to get into Oxford, you've kind of got to go to Oxford. You can't just turn around and say, no, I want to go to drama school instead, because people are going to say, you just got into Oxford, you fool, go there. So anyway.
All right. So I'm going to return back to the 1984 interview with Ian Martyr, conducted by Richard Marson in DWM 93. And this is picking up how he got the role as Harry Sullivan. And to quote the article, Barry Letts then came to Ian Martyr for a third time in 1974, this time to offer him the part of a regular companion. They cast me before they knew anything about the new Doctor. I was brought in case the Doctor had been made much older and couldn't handle the physical side of the series. I would have been his strong arm, a sort of rough-and-ready action type. As it was, Tom didn't really need me there at all. Ian will never forget his reaction on being asked to play Harry. I had been dreadfully ill for about 2 months, laid up in hospital and more or less at the death's door. I was only just getting back on my feet again about 5-6 months later when Barry asked me to meet him and his script editor Bob Holmes for lunch. This I did, and they outlined the concept of Harry to me. It took me about 3 seconds to say, I'll do it. I said yes with distinct alacrity.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. Though, of course, I mean, he looks fighting fit when you see him on the telly. You know, I mean, he's not obviously infirm in any kind of way. But obviously, you know, it's nothing like being on a stage every night and having to react and, you know, play to an audience and stay up late. And, you know, the whole drinking culture of being an actor is you know, obviously huge now.
But as a diabetic, Ian wouldn't have been drinking, right?
Well, no, but then again, yes, because that's the culture of being an actor. So, you know, I mean, who knows the kind of pressures that he's under.
And so it's almost a godsend to have steady work here in end of 1974, 1975
right.
6 months, half a year for a character Harry Sullivan, because if he was laid up in hospital for a couple months and then recovering, it does indicate that health problems may become a growing burden for Ian as his career progresses.
Yeah, and, you know, having a regular gig on the TV, you know, is I mean, there's a level of stress, I think, to any actor's life, but, you know, you're not in front of an audience each night, which is obviously, you know, his first love, obviously, was the theatre. And, you know, he was obviously getting some theatre work, but to have be able to do some, I guess, very minor movie work, but, you know, mainly TV stuff, Crown Court, Doctor Who, etc., was probably very helpful for him. And maybe this sort of explains his, you know, his moving into novelizations as well, possibly.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You know, this is, again, rampant speculation, but his acting credits, for theater at least, that I found really trailed off since his time in Doctor Who. And it could just be an increasing sign that last decade of his life that health concerns became tantamount.
Yeah. And, you know, and he had a wife and family, young family, that can be stressful.
Yep. Two kids, two sons.
Yep. You know, it's difficult to be out on the road as an actor if your wife is at home looking after the children or whatever happened in the 1970s. You know, that's also stressful. And I know nothing, very little about diabetes, but I'm sure being stressed doesn't help. So anyway, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Do you have a window open? Do you need a window open?
Oh, sorry. It's tornado excitement. And I'm trying to get some cold air in this room because it's like an oven. Let me just shut this one. Close this one a bit more.
Sorry.
Okay, that's right. No problem. No, you should say stuff like that because I've got my headphones in. I can't hear anything that's going on in the background.
Right.
At all.
Yeah, it's kind of funny. I can hear everything you're not hearing. You can hear everything I'm not hearing.
Exactly. Yeah, I can. Your house is a madhouse at the moment. I can't believe what Rita's up to.
Third World War.
Exactly. Pots and pans and good God. Pickleball.
Pickleball. Non-stop pickling.
Non-stop pickleball.
She just got home about an hour ago from playing pickleball for the last 4 hours. Oh, my God, woman.
Well, a man is off playing pickleball on Wednesday, so, yeah.
There you go.
Exactly.
Pickleball widowers.
Yeah. Pickleball widowers.
podcast.
All right. And the pickleball widowers, exactly. Combine that with a Blake 7 watch, with a new Blake 7 Blu-ray, then you've got...
Ooh, those are going to be nice.
You've got yourself a winner. Cool. Okay. All right. Where were we?
So if Robot, steady work, and what did you make of his first outing as Harry Sullivan?
It's hard, you know, because obviously I know and I like the character very much.
Right.
And, you know, obviously having glommed onto all the work you've done, I also, you know, I like him as a person as well. So distancing myself from that is a little bit tricky. I do remember, again, I always like to try and rewind my memory back to when I first saw this. And of course, you know, we were all very, very confused that there was a new doctor and like, you know, where had John Pertwee gone? We were all delighted that Sarah was still there because everyone loved Sarah. And Harry seemed to be, I can remember liking Harry from the get-go.
Mm-hmm.
And I can remember playing Doctor Who at school, which is what we would do, you know, all the kids would play varieties of Doctor Who. Until Blake 7 came along, and then we used to play varieties of Blake 7. It's like, well, who's the Doctor? Who's going to be Harry? Who's going to be Sarah? Et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And Harry was always, you know, it was a covetable role. This first outing, he doesn't have a huge amount to do.
Mm-hmm.
He seems mainly to be there so that the Doctor has an assistant while Sarah is being kidnapped and bonding with the King Kong. No, giant robot. No, the regular robot. which is fine, because, you know, the Doctor needs someone to talk to when he's doing a virus. The whole, like, I'm the man from the Ministry thing is hilarious.
Mm-hmm.
I love that bit. And, like, again, knowing a bit more about his acting background, that seems like, oh, yeah, that's real kind of cabaret stuff right there.
Right.
But he's a very affable, cheerful, just a stand-up, straight-shooting Englishman, which is, you know, exactly what the character's supposed to be. And he's got his blazer and he's got his cravat and he wears a naval uniform from time to time. And, it's a great start for him.
But he's also, it seems like he's a little bit forgotten in the middle of the story.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
So when he goes off to be undercover at Think Tank, even if you compare back to, like, Green Death with Mike Yates, who had more to do there at...
Global Chemicals.
At Global Chemicals.
Yeah.
Yeah, than Harry Sullivan did at Think Tank. So, in a way, it's almost as if Dix forgot what to do with him in the middle of the story, because he starts out strong.
Oh, yeah.
And you have that great scene with him.
Yeah.
No, Doctor, I'm the Doctor. And then he and Tom skip rope together and he winds up tied up inside a closet.
Yeah.
And at the end, you know, he also gets to throw a nice punch against Jellicoe. So he's bookend with some action and he's being the companion foil, as you said,
right,
for the Doctor.
Right.
But generally, in the middle, not much in episodes 2 or 3 for him.
I mean, obviously, he's the mole in Think Tank, so he's able to make a quick call to the Brigadier and say, Brigadier, like, they're in the bunker, which obviously we wouldn't know that unless there was some other kind of mole that we'd been cultivating within Think Tank. It's interesting you bring up Mike Yates, because obviously this story's little apart from the King Kong elements, It's a little bit of a retread of the dinosaur invasion. It's a bunch of scientists who want to reorganize the world so that it's better. I mean, I guess Kettlewell is that one.
Right.
Miss Hilda Winters is organized the world so that I can be ruler of it, which is slightly different from from the dinosaur folks. And in some ways, you know, Harry is kind of stepping into that Mike Yates role. He's undercover. Well, I guess he wasn't undercover in Invasion of Dinosaurs. He's undercover in Green Death, and then he's a brainwashed lunatic in Invasion of the Dinosaurs. So, you know, he's the undercover guy because we've lost Mike. Ended his arc with the spiders at the same time that we lost the Third Doctor. So he's that undercover role, which is vital to get that bit of the plot happening. And then, you know, I said, while Sarah's being kidnapped by the robot, he's able to help the doctor or ask the correct questions of the doctor while the doctor is cooking up his anti-metal virus that will soon put paid to the robot shenanigans.
Yeah, so I wonder...
Robotic shenanigans.
That's a band name right there.
Robotic shenanigans, exactly. Yeah, it's Kraftwerk. anyway, carry on. Yeah,
my thinking is with him. I think it's a little harsh because they set him up to be James Bond undercover, and then the kind of Sarah Jane's cutting remarks so much for James Bond when they find him.
Right.
When she comes in a room and finds him tied up in the storage closet where she's going to be tied up. You can kind of see the chemistry that develops over season 12 early on between Tom and Ian.
Right.
And I think he hit the nail on the head here. He is a bit of a recycled character, not only in echoes of Mike Yates from Green Death and Invasion of the Dinosaurs, but also reprising what we said, John Andrews from Carnival of Monsters with the naval lieutenant.
Right.
Dix wasn't being his most creative here in either devising this character along with Letts and bringing it to fruition. And really a naval officer stands out pretty sorely in the unit environment. This is the first naval officer, anyone in the Navy, that's been attached to unit.
True. Yeah. I mean, I suppose he's a surgeon commander, right? I think he's
lieutenant.
Lieutenant. Okay. I've always seen unit as a you know, it's not a regiment in the British Army.
No,
the United Nations Intelligence Task Force. So I mean, they gather the best and the brightest, the long haired, sideburned soldiers who don't want to have a proper haircut get to join unit. It's kind of like there's so much hair over the collar of those soldiers. Mm-hmm. It's absolutely disgraceful. But they do have proper berets, which always really irritates you about contemporary you, where they can never wear their berets right. That doesn't bother me at all. It seems, you know, it's kind of nicely Star Trek-y. He's the medical doctor. You know, he's from somewhere different. I mean, you know, naval doctor, and you're on board ship, different kind of ailments. I don't know. I mean, I guess what's kind of interesting is he never really does his doctor stuff, does he? After he joins the TARDIS crew for a short period of time, does he do doctoring?
Yeah, Ark in Space.
Oh yeah, I guess so. Yeah. You're right. No, he does pull out the stethoscope or his bedside manner.
But I mean, looking forward, he becomes the damsel basically by the time he leaves in Terror of the Zygons.
True.
That he's the one who gets wounded. He's the one who's bedridden. It's not a great character arc for Harry Sullivan.
No, it's a funny one. And I can see in some ways how it would have attracted a satirist or someone who was interested in satire, possibly, and avant-gardism, upsetting norms like possibly Ian Marta was, to have the ostensive male hero sort of end up being the damsel in distress, and the ostensive damsel in distress, Sarah Jane Smith, end up being the foil to the hero, you know, which is the hero is always the doctor. Well, I think, you know, increasingly with Tom Baker, the hero is the doctor. So, I mean, I think that makes a lot of sense. Just obviously we're not covering his subsequent stories in this particular podcast, but, you know, I can see him relishing the Harry Sullivan as an idiot of the character. That seems to be something that I think would appeal to an actor like Ian Marta.
It could. I don't know if it was presented to him like that when Letts and Holmes presented the character to him. I think he was thinking that he'd be the young buck who was getting into scraps and that type of stuff, and may not be what he signed on for.
Yeah, maybe. Yeah.
It's hard to say exactly what he thought while he was doing the role, but he is on record saying he really thought it was time to go because of the way the character turned out. So he wasn't very happy with it.
Fair enough, though we do know that the memory cheats with Ian Marta because we know that he kind of papered over his post-Oxford years. So, you know, I don't know. Anyway, yeah. I mean, I don't see him being unhappy with the part. You know, there's no obvious... I mean, I think of Tom in his last year, and it's so clear that he's like, I really don't want to do this anymore. This is horrible. And you're like, well, he should probably just go right now. So, I mean, and of course, you know, Tom Baker is a very particular individual who, you know, really couldn't conceal that kind of discomfort. But I don't see that with Ian Marta at all in his, you know, in Zygons, for instance. He still seems to have to be having a gay old time, you know.
But for Harry, I think the character for Ian... He, unlike Tom, is playing a role.
Fair.
He is playing a character. Tom is playing himself. So I think there is more separation from Martyr's perspective on the Sullivan character than Baker's perspective on the Doctor.
Yeah, no, that's true. That's true. That's true. That's fair enough. Yeah. Mm.
But at least in this first story, there's definitely good team rapport between the three main leads. But it's also, unlike many other companion introductions, I mean, you'd have to go pretty much all the way back to Spearhead from Space, where you're introducing the companion and a new Doctor
right
at the same time. And then before that, you go all the way back to An Earthly Child, where you introduce the whole cast. So it's pretty uncommon where you have a new companion being introduced along with the Doctor.
Is it clear that he's a new companion? It's to me, in some ways, right until the end of the, you know, the last couple of minutes of the final episode of Robot, you know, in some ways, are you expecting Harry to become a TARDIS crew member?
You know, that's a good, really good point. I don't think there's really, aside from being the Doctor's foil, he's kind of a guest cast member that, like Fraser Hines, is asked on at the very final moments to join the TARDIS with the jelly baby scene.
Yeah, yeah. Just having watched it, you know, obviously quite recently for this podcast, he really was like, oh, yeah, okay, I guess he is going to be part of the TARDIS now, though. So obviously, you know, it was planned. Well, we're told it was planned.
Right.
But it seems a little bit last minute that he's being asked to jump on and go inside the TARDIS and find himself on Space Station Nerva the next time he comes out of the TARDIS, which obviously is a big shock for everybody.
Yeah.
Though, yeah, I don't know.
So it's not quite the traditional character building story that most companions get because the focus is on Tom Baker's debut.
Right.
True. And so it isn't telegraphed at all that Ian is going to come on as Harry and be a companion for the rest of the season.
Right. Yeah, no, again, fair enough. Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, true. So, yeah, a good point. Yeah. Other than that, I think there's enough given to Martyr to work with at the beginning of this beginning, but it's not his strongest story as Harry Sullivan.
No, absolutely.
The focus is on Tom, and even Sarah gets way more to do than Harry.
Yeah. You know, it's a fun story.
Yeah.
And it's not the greatest story, though.
No.
There are some real kind of dodgy bits in it. And there's a huge amount to enjoy in Robert. In fact, there's enough to enjoy that it doesn't seem to be that dodgy. But if you look at it, yeah, it's pretty daft. A lot of it, especially the whole SRS plan to nuke the world.
Yeah.
Nuke the world. And it's a countdown. You know, while the countdown's on, let's go down and see how many cans of beans we have. maybe we should just check on that now. It's a silly story which has some great acting in it. The robot is just a miraculous piece of costume design and
great design.
Really. And then, you know, Mike, again, just watching it is like Michael Kilgariff's bravery in walking around, walking downstairs, walking backwards, doing a bunch of stuff in that costume is, wow, you got to hand it to the man. That is a brave, brave actor. Anyway.
Yeah. Watching it this time around, I was struck by how loose and shoddy I thought the directing was from Christopher Barry on bits of it. I mean, there were some brilliant aspects when they're in Kettlewell's laboratory when Sarah is defending the doctor against the robot, and you have a high camera angle to accentuate how big the robot is compared to Sarah. But generally, you would basically have to be Camfield, and I'm not even sure Camfield would be able to salvage this, because it's silly how much shooting there is and nothing hits. And when they're using Sarah and the robot as shields, obviously have clear lines of sight. And it just, I think it was very exciting if I was 8 or 9 watching this, but now 45 plus years later, it doesn't hold up as well as memory would have you hold it up.
There's I mean, you're right about Camfield. There's a lot of military stuff in this. And again, I complimented the costume of people on getting people's berets right. But there's a lot of really shoddy military stuff that someone like Doug Camfield would have not allowed to happen.
Right.
Unit of basically shooting in a circle around the robot.
Right.
So basically shooting each other. I've never been in the military, but I'm going to guess that's something that soldiers don't do.
Right.
You stand in one bit and then you shoot away from yourself. And, you know, obviously the tank is a, you know, I don't know, the air comes out of the entire story when that kind of clanks into view. For me anyway, it's like, yeah, that's really not, that's just an Action Man tank. That's not a tank at all. So, you know, and again, I think with just a little bit more military know-how, kind of Sea Devil style, maybe,
yeah,
it could have tightened up quite considerably.
Mm-hmm. And the reprises at the beginning of every episode are really long. And I think Dix is pulling a Terry Nation here in many ways. He's recycling a lot of ideas, and he could have given Ian Martyr more to do as Harry Sullivan in those middle episodes. If you cut down on the long reprises at 2, 3, and 4 from the previous episodes.
Yeah, yeah, and they are long. They are long. They're long reprises, which, you know, you don't.
Couple minutes each, yeah.
Yeah, which you don't notice in serialized drama really that much. But watching it episode by episode as we do nowadays,
yeah,
that's really noticeable.
Yeah. Yeah. Yep.
Well, yes.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So I don't have much more to say on Robot, I guess.
I think I've covered my robot opinion. My robotic opinions have been given at this point.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, we now look forward to the space station stuff.
We're going to pick up producer Philip Hinchcliffe and move into one of the greats of Tom Baker's era.
The Ark in Space. Yeah, yeah.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, thank you for listening to episode 255 of the Metabulous 2 podcast. I have been skipping rope with Ben.
And I have been engaging in robotic shenanigans with David, probably.
Do, 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 do.
All right. All goodbye, right. Everybody.
Bye.
Bye.
Been
come on, think of something witty on the spot.